Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
I'm Sheila Shoiga, and welcome to Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognise, others you might not. But my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. In this episode, I speak to the owner and founder of 2210 Patisserie, Una Leonard.
Nobody knew, I never spoke to anybody about it. I got up, I still went to work every day. I went to college every day. I went and played my camogie. I had a big smile on my face. And I continued to do what I wanted to do every day. Like, my life was so normal from the outside, like, so normal. Like, even when I tell people about it now or I talk about it now, they're like, what? No way, that, not you. Like, no way. And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, oh, we just thought you lost a bit of weight. Like, we never even thought of that you were going through all of that.
Una runs a very successful bakery business and has a gorgeous, upbeat personality that at one point hit a deep unhappiness. In this conversation, we get a beautiful insight into her relationship with her mam, the bond she also had with her granny, fondly known as Doty, and how baking and opening up her bakery ultimately became her saviour. I learned so much from listening to her about the power her words can have on children in particular, and how our attitude to food can impact those around us. It's an extremely challenging listen at times, as we don't shy away from the reality of her experience of attempted suicide. So please check the show notes before you play it, as it's important to be aware in advance. This is Una speaking her truth, and it's powerful. So first up, congratulations on your massively successful shop and online business, which is also equally huge. Of 2210 Patisserie. Did I pronounce it right?
Yes, you did.
Actually, first up, tell us how you got the name, or it got the name.
Okay, so I was coming up with a name and I didn't want something to put my name to it. And I made my first cakes for my little nephew, Connor. And he was born on the 2nd of the 2nd, 2010. Aww. So I used his date of birth as the name.
Cuteness. Yeah. Love that.
Oh, and he loves it as well. He goes around telling everyone. He's every teacher in the school told. There's a bakery named after me.
That's awful cute. And come here, you have been in business for 7 years now.
7 years now, yeah. Is it seven? I've lost count.
Yeah. But in recent years, probably in the past two-ish, three.
Yeah.
You've been flying it.
Yeah. COVID was a massive help for us. Like,
so was it?
When we moved online and really pushed ourselves there. So yeah, we got a lot of exposure then.
And then, of course, having high profile people, you know, say that your cakes are gorgeous. And that's a huge help too, because you've made cakes, I know, for Pip O'Connor. You did Maeve Madden's wedding cake.
Yeah.
I mean, that's massive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, it literally massive.
Was it? It was. What are we talking? How many hours of work went into it?
On average, if I was going to set up a wedding cake, it might take me 45 minutes to an hour to set up. This one took me about 6 hours to set up.
Right. What are we talking?
And a ladder.
Okay, so it's like scaffolding around the thing.
It was literally like building a house. It took me so long just to even get everything into our Manor, and then actually to start putting it together and then putting all the flowers on it and everything. But it was phenomenal. It was class. It was
so really it's good. Individual cakes that just basically stack on top of each other.
Stack on top of each other. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was like seven tiers of individual cakes. And then there was like hand sculpted the names on the front of it. Yeah.
Who was the first high profile person that ordered a cake from you?
Actually, I think it was Pippa. So some company, I actually think it was Belaine Coffee, who had ordered a box of cupcakes to bring up to them randomly in their new offices that they'd set up.
Yeah.
And they brought up the cupcakes. That was fine. It was grand at the time. And then 2 days later, I got a message off Pippa and she was like, "So we had your cupcakes the other day. Is there anybody you do a cake for me?" And I was like, "Yeah, of course I will." No problem at all. So it was literally just they had cupcakes and then it kind of snowballed from there. And then I've done all of their cakes since. So.
Yeah.
And I love being part of people's celebrations like that. It's really nice. So
yeah. Fabulous. Fabulous. Okay. Let's learn a little bit more about you, because I've been following you for some time and drooling over your cakes. But I didn't really know anything other than you've got such a gorgeous, sparkling personality whenever I see you on stories, and you love to bake and you're good at it. But I didn't really know anything else. So as a teenager, a lot of us have memories of being insecure and awkward, because it's not an easy time for anyone. It's challenging being a teenager. But for you, it was particularly tricky.
Yeah. So when I was in secondary school, I probably struggled really bad with how I looked and how I felt in my own body. I wasn't very secure at all. I didn't like eating around people, which I actually, the more I think about this, I think this came from even younger years, when my granny used to live with us and we used to go down to her house. Mam never had any sweet things in our house. So we used to go down to granny's and she'd give us treats, and we used to hide the treats from Mam and Dad and not show them that we were eating them.
Yeah.
So then when I got into secondary school and I was struggling with eating I used to struggle really badly with eating on front of people, because I would be worried about what they thought and what they were thinking. And in my head, I'd be like, if I was eating on somebody, I'd be taking a bite out of a slice of toast in the morning. I'd be like, everybody's looking at me going, "Oh, look, the fat one is eating." But I was never that big, or I was never that fat or anything like that. But
it was just your inner voice.
Yeah, it was saying that to me all of the time.
Yeah.
So it just, I used to sweat. I was so uncomfortable eating in front of people. I can't even describe it. It was so uncomfortable for me. So then it just got to a stage where I would stop eating. I stopped eating until one of my lovely teachers actually noticed that I had stopped eating, and she used to pull me back for 10 minutes of our big lunch, and she would allow me that area and that space with her to eat comfortably for 10 minutes and actually have lunch.
And were you able to eat then?
I was able to eat just one-on-one with her, yeah, no problem. But the days that she wasn't in, or the days that she didn't hold me back, or she had lunch break, she was on duty, I wouldn't eat at all.
Oh no, wow.
Yeah, but I was also very conscious of the smells of food, and my sisters used to bring tuna and bring everything. I'd be like, "Oh, God, no, I couldn't bring that in, because that would attract attention to me, what's in my lunchbox." So even if I was to bring food in, it would be maybe a few rice cakes or crackers or an apple. I'd have to look like I'm eating healthy. I couldn't eat anything bad in front of people.
And at home, was that also the same, that you didn't feel comfortable eating in front of your family?
Oh God, no. No, no, no. It was always snap, whoever can get as much food as possible.
You're grand at home.
Yeah, grand at home.
Isn't that interesting? Right. So it was only outside of your safety of the home environment that this kind of manifested.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was wrapped up in just, I suppose, deep teenage insecurity.
Insecurity.
You had this idea of yourself where you looked in the mirror, you saw something different to what everybody else saw.
Oh, completely. Oh, without a doubt. Yeah, I definitely did. But then that would have always been triggered from small comments that would have been said over the years, even from primary school and early years in secondary school. I definitely was called fat on a number of occasions. And I was only thinking about this on the way up here. And I was like, I remember so well being called a fat so-and-so, but I can't remember the days that I got my A's or the days that we won like games or we don't. But yeah. I remember, I can even negative. See the person. I can see the boy that called. I can. There was three or four of them, and I remember. I can see it. I can remember where it happened. I can tell you the ins and outs of it. But that all stuck with me. But the days that something positive happened didn't really stick with me. So I presume like they're all the earlier days. Like that sticks with you, and then when you move on, I think that's probably where my food
and the paranoia grows.
Yeah.
Words are so powerful, aren't they?
So powerful.
What we say to young people, what we say to kids.
Oh, sticks. It's so dangerous. So dangerous what we say.
Yeah, it is. And it's something that we all need to be, whether we have kids or not, it's something to, because we all interact with kids at some point.
Yeah.
To be aware of the language we're using. Even if it's used innocently, we really have to think, how is this going to impact that young person?
Yeah, of course.
And what you're saying.
Yeah, and even through humour we use it, but...
Yeah, and it's a very Irish thing, isn't it?
Such an Irish thing to do. Such an Irish thing, yeah. When I was younger, Mum was going to kill me for saying this. I remember she called me fat. She didn't... She said it in a humorous way. She was like, oh, it must have been an apple tart or something she had out, and I went to take my second or maybe third slice, and she was like, just, you know, you can't be eating that, you'll get fat. Like, just a joke.
I get you. I joke. Like, no, I know. And we're not demonising your lovely mam. It's do you know
she's
what?
She's going to love this. I didn't eat at home. I did not eat. I went on strike, did not eat for 4 or 5 days. Just every time she said to me, Una, will you please just sit down and eat your dinner? I was like, no, because you called me fat.
Okay.
And I just went on strike. But little did she know, she was ringing my neighbour, Imelda, down the road, and I was going down having my dinner with her every day. She only told me that a couple of years later, that they actually knew that I was still eating.
I'll show her.
Oh, that's pure stubbornness now.
Yeah. But it's a good point, because, you know, we often say things about kids, whether they're tall or short, whether they're eating or not, and it might be said innocently, but is that good enough? Maybe not. Maybe we need to do our homework, because we don't know how that's going to impact them in years to come. Mm-hmm. And as you said, stuff that was said to you pre-teens starts to manifest in your teenage years as, oh, I can't do this. Yeah. I can't eat around other people. So at school, and thankfully that teacher noticed, how bad did it get?
So I'd say in sixth year, it got to its worst, where I was not eating at all. I wouldn't eat during the day. So I struggled actually to eat breakfast as well. Like, Mam used to, she was very strict on what we ate, as in everything was always like wholesome, and it was her own homemade brown bread, and it was always a dinner when we come home from school. She was really, really good with us, but I would have struggled to eat anything. I'd be kind of like, no, I don't want it. I'm pushing it away, always pushing it away. But when I come home, there was always a dinner, but I'd start getting a little bit picky about what I wanted to eat and what I didn't want to eat.
And were they noticing it at home?
Mam was definitely noticing it, because she had so much control on what we ate anyway, because she was making everything. She made our lunches. God, I feel like we sound like we're spoiled, but Mam actually made our lunches up until we were in sixth year. Like, she used to get up before us, rise and shine, everybody up, get all the lunches ready and get them out. And it was still like we were in primary school. And she always had a dinner ready for us, always, every evening when we come home from school.
Yeah.
But I did see myself pushing that away, pushing that aside, like, a lot.
So, I mean, it was a full-blown eating disorder.
Yeah. And it was just when, by the time I got into, and I transitioned into college, that's when the anorexia and the bulimia really started.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what was a typical day like for you?
In secondary school?
Well, you're saying sixth year, and then kind of after that you go into college, and this is when you, as you said it yourself, that you're anorexic and bulimic.
Yeah. So like, my typical day would be like around food. I would probably not eat much up until about 2 o'clock, 1 or 2 o'clock, and I would try and eat something small then. I would live on like maybe a coffee beforehand, but it was all thoughts. It was all in my head. So it was always me telling myself I didn't need anything, I'm not hungry. Or I'd survive on that empty feeling. I actually used to love that empty feeling, that feeling of feeling like you had nothing inside you and you felt light. I don't know how to describe that if somebody has never went through it, but it was a really good feeling. It was really nice and you felt good.
So you were kind of getting a dopamine hit probably from that.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And then it was the transition and then into college when you didn't, like, I knew I had the security of every evening when I come home, there was a meal sitting there waiting for me and ready for me. But when I went into college, that wasn't there. So I had the choice whether I wanted or not. And more than likely, I didn't want it.
So you went to college in Galway?
I went to college in Galway, yeah.
So you were living in Galway?
Living in Galway, yeah.
So you had full control over what it went into your body or not, as the case may be.
Yeah, full control, but absolutely no control whatsoever, because I had lost control at that stage.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, like, I was studying culinary arts. I was studying culinary arts and business. So I was in the kitchens. And, like, we were like, tasting food all of the time. We were learning about food. We were learning about flavors. We were, like, yeah, we were around food all of the time. And I loved that. I loved that. Like, once you put me into a kitchen, I'm absorbing all of that. But just for me, like, personally, I just didn't want to be or eat any of the food.
And did you have to as part of your training?
Yeah, I did, of course. I had to eat some, I had to taste, obviously, some dishes, but that, I suppose that's where the bulimia came in. Like, I was always straight out. And I had it down to a T. I knew exactly how many cups of water I'd have to drink. And if I waited 16 minutes after having a meal, that it would come out, like, quicker than it would if I waited 5 or 10 minutes. It'd be too hard to get up. Like, I had it to a T, like.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And nobody knew?
Nobody knew at that time, because I was on the go so much. I was working in restaurants. I was in college. I was getting home to play camogie. My nephew was young at the time. So it was you're all over the place. You're literally just trying to, like, tap into all of these different worlds that you have, like, to try and see everybody. So I might only have seen mom, like, maybe for 2 hours a week, because I was on the go so much. So nobody was there, and nobody could see enough of me to realize that that was happening.
Yeah. And so I suppose normal, air quotes, life is continuing, because you're still keeping up your camogie training, you're doing all the normal things.
Yes.
But your life is far from normal.
No. You're just holding on. You're just trying to take control of something. And that's the only thing I had control of, like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was your attitude towards food then? You said you loved being in the space when you were studying.
Yeah. It's really, really hard to describe, because I love food, and I love being around food, and I love the food connects you to people, so everybody can sit around a table and have laughter and have conversation around really good food. I love that element of it. But for me, I could sit there and I could be sweating with the thoughts of having to eat a meal in front of people. So it's still really hard. Like, I still tap into both of those kind of thoughts now and again, but, like, yeah, it's hard to understand it. I still don't fully understand it.
Mm-hmm. I'd love if you talk about your granny.
Yeah, so I was in my, it was the 4th of October 2011, and my beloved granny passed away. So granny would have lived at the end of our house. So we had a granny flat for her, where I actually live now at the moment. So she was another parent to us.
Yeah.
She was, like, so much part of our younger years and our life. We spent every day with her. She minded us. She'd done everything for us. She cooked us food, brown bread. She was out playing hurling with us. She'd done absolutely everything. Like, she was just a gas woman. So she passed away. And I suppose everything that I was holding together as a person up until that point, I couldn't hold it anymore. I let it all go. When you're, was it 18?
Yeah.
You just don't know how to deal or cope with such a massive loss. And I certainly didn't know how to cope with it. I never, ever thought that she was going to go. Like, even though she had Alzheimer's and she was getting sick. And we knew, like, everybody knew it was going to happen at some stage. You still just don't expect it to happen. Mm. Like, you just don't expect her to go. Like, you expect her to be there forever.
Mm. And, like, it's obvious, even talking about her now, it's bringing up a lot for you, and it's difficult to talk about her. Her name was Mary, but she was known as
Doty.
And you have a special bar in your bakery named after her.
Yeah, I actually came and hawed about changing the name of the bakery to Doty, and then I decided, when I invented my own bars,
the Doty bars.
So it's so funny. Everyone comes into the cafe now, and they're like, they're asking about Doty, and I hear her name every day, and I'm just like, oh, this is lovely.
Yeah.
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 And she's such a sweet too as well. She would have loved it.
So she was a massive loss. Massive.
Massive, but also the first.
Yeah. And 18.
Yeah.
You know, you're still so young.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're not taught about it. And I know there's not much teaching you can do about loss at that age. But it was kind of a 3 or 4 days of her funeral, and she was gone, and you were trying to figure out, like, what happens next. But, like, I was straight back down to college on the Tuesday, like, and it was like, get this done, assignments to be done, this has to be done. And I was like,
life goes on.
Hold on, does nobody realise what just happened? Like, am I the only one here that understands that she's gone? Like, what how am I supposed to just do assignments again? Like,
yeah. And also, like, the all you had going on yourself at the time, you were already, you were suffering.
Yeah.
You were trapped in this very negative spiral that, you know, you were probably not even fully cognizant of at this stage.
Yeah.
So you were really vulnerable to begin with. And then this huge figure in your life, it's been such a positive influence, is taken away from you. And you're, as you said, you're not really taught how to grieve necessarily. Yeah. So it was massive.
It was massive. And my body and how I dealt with it was, I felt the emotion for, I'd say, 4 or 5 days, and then I just went numb.
Okay.
I pushed it so far down, I only took it up about 2 years ago to deal with.
Is that all?
Yeah, I wasn't ready. I was not ready.
Yeah.
And even dealing with it 2 years ago, when I actually took the plunge into dealing with it, it's still hard to cope with.
You're still processing.
Yeah, still processing. Yeah, completely.
What made you go there 2 years ago and think about it?
I felt I was in a strong space to be able to dive into everything that happened and try and understand it.
Good on you.
And I really wanted to figure it all out. I wanted to understand why this happened, how it happened, how do I prevent that in the future if I need to, or what are the signs of it if I ever need to help somebody else to see that they're going through something similar. Because you're like me going through it, like it's a complete and utter blur. Like I have 3 or 4 years there that I had to try and still half and fully figured it all out. And it's only been going through this over the last 2 years that we're actually putting parts of it back together. And I'm like, oh, I remember that now. Or Mam might remember something that happened and I don't remember it at all.
Yeah.
So we're just trying to figure it all out.
Okay, so you have put it in a box somewhere, but you've pushed that box away and you're going, yeah, I'm done with that now, I'm not dealing with that.
Yeah.
And we're back in college and we're getting our assignments done. But all the while, you know, your I suppose warped attitude to food and your body is growing all the time.
Yeah. I think I took more control because I was so numb everywhere else. My control thing now was this.
Okay.
This was the only thing I had control of. Everything else was gone. So I really, really took control of it. I would have went online and looked at all of the pro-anorexia sites and just to make sure that I knew I was getting all the tips and I knew exactly what I was doing and how I was doing it and I was doing it the right way. My eating had gone down to, I think I had one cup of peas a day.
What?
One cup of peas a day. One cup of peas. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, and that was for a long time. Yeah, I passed out behind the wheel when I was driving on my way home from a Camogie game in Sligo because I had not properly ate for a couple of days, which was a big, like, cop on to me at that stage. Mam wanted to keep me at home after that.
That's very scary. Did you just nod off and came back to yourself?
I nodded off, wrote off my car and...
Whoa.
It was when I was driven home and brought home, and that's when I think that was the time that Mam really realised that this was not good.
Yeah.
But then on the other side, my family were grieving. My family were going through this whole process as well. So like there's only so much, like I feel like even looking back now that like after that time, after Granny had passed away, everybody dealt it in their own ways, but because I was still very vulnerable beforehand, I feel like I took so much of Mam's attention away from my brother and sisters who probably needed it as well.
But it, like, you know, I suppose at the end of the day, like if there's one person that needs a bit more attention, I don't think anyone would begrudge a sibling or anyone, you know, at the end of the day, you did need it.
Yeah.
Where do you come in the family? Because I know you have 2 sisters and a brother.
Yeah, so I have 2 older sisters and 1 younger brother. And we're all like within 4 years of each. Like Mam popped us all out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
One after another.
Yeah. Right, so you're at home. At this stage, are you kind of at home for a period of time?
I would have been home for Christmas time, I would say, around that time before I went back to college again. So
your granny had passed away in that October. Christmas.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And it gets darker. It gets a lot darker.
Yeah, yeah. So when I was 19, I was... this continued on for quite a while. So like this dark place that I probably was. But I was soothing myself. I used to soothe myself when I got anxiety around people or around food or around like that. And I used to say, I just used to bring myself to this place where I could run away to. And I don't know why, but Cork was always the place I could get into my car, drive and not come back for a few days. Or I could just get away from everything. That was always my thought. I could get away from it. But when I was 19 and, yeah, I was around 19, I remember having a really, really bad panic attack in college after a full day of, we were almost been 4 or 8 hours. I can't remember the class that we'd done, but we were after cooking these like 4-course meals. And I remember we were all sitting around to get the knives and forks out and taste them. And like this panic rose in me. I could not control it at all. And I just ran out of the room. And I remember thinking to myself, it wasn't Cork I wanted to go to anymore. I just did not want to be here anymore. Like that was my first time thinking, this is not where I want to be at all. I didn't want to come back. And then those thoughts, unfortunately, were very frequent then after the next couple of weeks.
Are you okay?
Yeah. Yeah, they were quite frequent. And nobody knew, I never spoke to anybody about it. I got up, I still went to work every day, I went to college every day, I went and played my camogie, I had a big smile on my face, and I continued to do what I wanted to do every day. Like my life was so normal from the outside, like so normal. Like even when I tell people about it now or I talk about it now, they're like, what? No way, that not you. Like, no way. And I'm like, yeah, yeah. And they're like, oh, we just thought you lost a bit of weight. Like, you never even thought of that you were going through all of that.
And that's really, when you say this, as much as it's, I can only begin to imagine how difficult it is, because you're revisiting a very, very tough time in your life. But you're also, by being so open and honest, you're also really helping other people who listen to this, whether they're worried about themselves or other people, because a smile and a bubbly personality, which yeah. you have, can hide a multitude and yeah. can hide an ocean of pain.
Yeah.
We sometimes don't have a clue what's going on with people.
Not a clue. Not a clue.
And I have heard that a lot of people who kind of make the decision or make peace with this idea that I don't want to be here anymore, as you said, they kind of feel a lightness, like a weight is lifted.
Oh, I remember it to this day. I can sit at the front porch of my house again. I can feel it, that decision that I made. And I just remember for the first time in weeks not being in the dark hole anymore. I remember being genuinely happy. It was so hard to feel that feeling because I was so numb for so long. But I remember genuinely being so happy sitting on my front porch, and like the porch is tiny, so my legs were literally, I just remember holding onto my legs, like I was literally curled up. I could hear my dad and my brother probably fighting in the background about something because they were up the yard. And I just said, I'm going to be with Granny. Granny's going to look after me. It's going to be fine. Like, sure. I'm just annoying people here. Like, I am just wrecking everybody's head. I'm putting everybody through torture. Granny will look after me. And that was always my thing. Granny is going to look after me. She always did. That was always where you went to. And I was so happy. I was so happy.
Whoa.
For weeks, I was in the dungeons. Like, I had terrors going to bed every night. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I hated myself. I was scratching myself. I couldn't be in other people's company because I had anxiety. And then all of a sudden, I had this light bulb moment and I was like, yeah.
And was your behaviour different then around family? Then you had this kind of, I suppose it sounds almost like a peace washed over you.
Yeah. Yeah, so, oh God, I act on things fairly fast. There was no change in my mind there.
Right.
And nobody knew that I had made that decision, only me. I went down, I remember it so well. I remember standing up and walking down and I could feel the breeze in my face, and I just remember having like this smile on my face. I went into my sister's house, which is my granny's flat at the end of the house, and we must have had 4 or 5 cups of tea and gossiped all evening, which we wouldn't have done that for ages.
Yeah.
And I remember her thinking and saying, or she said it to me, or she said something about like, I think she gave me a hug and she was just like, that was so good. Or like, I just remember it being like a really nice interaction we had with each other. We had a lovely evening together. We just had a lovely time, and it wasn't tiptoed around me. It was just,
yeah. And was she thinking, I wonder, she's back. She's back for herself.
I thought she must have felt, yeah. She knew by me that I was happy in that moment, in that time. I don't think she would have thought the other. She definitely didn't think that I was suicidal at that time. She definitely knew that I just had this happiness, and maybe I was just having a blip of it, and she was absorbing it because we wouldn't have had it for so long.
Yeah.
And I remember Connor, my little nephew, like playing, and we were messing around with him for ages. And at that stage, I went back up to my room and I wrote a little letter to both of them. And then I could hear Mam shouting or something in the kitchen. So I went up to Mam, and it was kind of later into the evening now. And I went up to Mam and I actually had a cup of tea. And I think I definitely ate something, because I just remember everybody being happy around the table that I had sat there and drank a cup of tea and ate something with them. So whether it was, it could have been a biscuit, it could have been something. I just remember eating something there. And it was just like everyone kind of looked at each other and was like, okay, this is happening.
Yeah.
And that night, I had a shower and I got into my jammies. And as had become a frequent occasion, Mam gets into the bed beside me and just gets me through the terrors part of the night so I can get myself to sleep. I would only have normally slept for like 2 or 3 hours anyway before I woke up in terrors again. And she put her arm around me. And when she went off to go to sleep, she thought I would sleep. And then I just said a little prayer to God that they'd all be safe. And I took an overdose of everything. I had saved them for, I'd say I had like plenty of painkillers in the room.
Yeah.
And then I had got some earlier that day. And I told Granny that I was coming for her.
Jesus.
And I was so happy.
Were you?
I was so happy. I didn't do it with the thoughts that, oh, feel sorry for her. Or I didn't think about what my family would have went through. I honestly was just so happy. And I just knew Granny was going to look after me.
But obviously you're here.
Yeah.
You're here and we're talking. Yeah. So
I woke up the next morning.
You woke up, yeah.
I woke up the next morning. I was so ill and there was nothing in me to get sick. So I was just puking yellow lumps. And I was really dizzy and I was really faint. I was very shaky. I remember going up to the toilet and I was so weak. So weak. I was so fragile. I think that was probably the most brittle I felt ever. And I don't know if that was because I was so annoyed with myself that I couldn't do that, or it was because I had taken so much, or it was because I was at rock bottom, because I had went from a happy place and I was after plunging straight back down again.
So yeah, so there wasn't a sense of relief that you woke up?
No. No, it was a sense of, you are so stupid, you can't even kill yourself.
Oh, stop. Jesus.
And then I just kept thinking all day, oh, I should have took 2 or 3 more. Or what should I have done? Like, how did I do that so wrong? I was so annoyed with myself. And I remember all day just scratching my hand. Like, all day. Like, and I just sitting there and wondering, like, why? How did I mess that up? And my sister Joan came home from college that weekend, and like everybody was at home, and I was just like, could not believe it. I was like, they should be at my funeral. I should be with Granny now. And they're all just getting ready for camogie games or playing around. And
so did nobody know what it
was? Oh, God, nobody knew. Nobody knew.
You never said it to anyone?
Nobody.
Oh, my God.
I remember it was... I wasn't the following day. I think we had camogie training the following day, but I didn't go. I stayed in bed all that day. Most of the day, I wasn't able for anybody that day. And then the next day, I think we had a camogie game or a tournament or something. And I remember going to that. And I remember being so brittle and weak on the pitch.
Can I ask about writing the letters?
Mm-hmm.
And how you felt?
It was happiness. I was offloading how I felt onto them letters.
Okay.
To make sure that they knew that I was in a really good place and that I was happy and that this was the right thing, and like me and Granny were going to look after them. That was the majority of the letters, what it said.
Yeah.
It was that we were going to look after them and that they were all going to be okay.
Oh. Unfortunately, this isn't where this part of your story ends.
No. So it was. It may have been a few weeks later. I can't even remember the time frame of it. But obviously still very low. There was very little good days. Probably no good days at this stage. But I went out with my sister Orla. We went to Navan, which we would normally have with our friends. And it was the October bank holiday weekend. So it was the Sunday night of it. And at that stage, I'd be very anxious around people, like very, very anxious around people. But she would have known that I was, like, everybody would have known that I was low.
Yeah.
And everybody wanted me, the Una, back. But that particular night, I couldn't handle it. I wasn't even there that long, but there was too many people.
You got overwhelmed.
It got completely overwhelmed. And I had a really bad panic attack. So I ran back down the stairs out of the club or nightclub or pub, whatever we were in, and Orla followed me down. And I remember sitting on a really cold window ledge in Navan and just not being able to breathe, and she's sitting beside me, and I just remember seeing her face, and she was just like, oh god, this is actually happening to you. And I had to explain to her, I was like, Orla, this is all the time. I hate myself so much. I can't be here anymore. I can't eat. I don't sleep. I don't do any. I literally cannot do this anymore. And she knelt down and held my two hands, and she was like, we are going to get help.
Yeah.
So then we went home that night, and the next morning Orla packed me up into the car and off we went to A&E in Navan. And we got help that day. So we were waiting a very long time, as you do.
Yeah.
And we had the kindest nurse. Like, do you know when you go places like that and you nearly need to be with somebody that's really kind, that you're able to open up, and you could have got somebody completely different. But I think that day I was so lucky.
Mm.
I was so lucky. This lady, I can't even remember her name. I don't know who she was, but I just remember being able to explain to her how I was feeling.
Yeah.
And it could have been completely different. I told her exactly how I was feeling, and I told her about my suicide attempt. And Orla was in the corner. Hearing this for the first time. I think that was probably one of the hardest parts at all.
Yeah.
So that had started, my medical help, obviously, at that day. But also Orla had a lot to deal with then, because she had realised how bad things were. I actually am still not fully sure what she done. I think she may have told people. Maybe Mam would have known. Mothers not always know.
Yeah.
But so we got help from there. But one of the paths to help is counselling. Mm. Is what they automatically, I think, do and put you towards, is to try and talk it out, which I understand now, but I was only ready 8 years on to speak about. I definitely wasn't ready 2 or 3 weeks on from that suicide attempt to speak about.
Yeah.
And I remember we got the appointment, and it was very positive at home, because there was something going to happen and we were going to take the steps, and I was open to getting help at this stage.
Mm.
So we got the appointment. It was for trim, and again, we went over to the appointment, and again, had an absolutely wonderful lady. I remember if I met her in the street, I'd know her. I could see her. And she was so nice and so kind. And she sat me down and we started talking. But she spoke about the triggers. She spoke about Granny. And she spoke about my eating disorder and how it would have started from younger days of being with Granny. So she wanted to understand those days. So I was talking about Granny a lot and I was telling her all about it and how amazing she was. And it just, it prodded me and it poked me and it brought me back to wanting to go back to Granny.
Okay.
And we spoke about a lot that day. And she helped me understand some things. I do remember that. But I just remember coming out and like, I remember self-soothing on the way home in the car. And my self-soothing, you can see me now scratching my hand. Yeah. My self-soothing was always scratching my hands or scratching my face. And a lot of the times that would have went to me bleeding or it was as far as I could get. But I was fighting with myself. I was like, my thoughts were running. I was saying, I was remembering back to that happiness I had a few weeks previous of wanting to be with Granny so much and going back to that. So I think in that time, I rushed my decision and just plunged into this. I need to get to Granny. I need to get to Granny. So I tried to commit suicide again that evening when I came home. That one, I didn't wake up at home. I woke up in the hospital from that one.
So unfortunately, you nearly did it this time.
Yeah. Yeah, I was hoping that I wouldn't make the mistake twice. And I just remember waking up and seeing Mam and Dad.
In the hospital. Hadn't you taken the same, it was the same kind of concoction of painkillers?
More stronger ones. I remembered it was, a different concoction. But when I woke up and seen Mam and Dad, I think I actually just closed my eyes and went back to sleep and kind of thought it was all a dream. And it's all such a blur. Like, it's such a blur. Like, I can't understand how our bodies can do it, can just like block it out and like not remember any of it. But when I speak to Mam about it, she remembers it.
Yeah. And can you talk about it?
Yeah.
You okay?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Take your time.
So from that day and from when I got released from hospital, that time we started into rehab. So I actually had lost control at this stage. So I wasn't in control anymore. I didn't feel in control anymore. Whereas before it was always a conscious decision. Okay, maybe I was not in the right mind to make the decision, but it was a conscious decision to do these things. Whereas now I was just like, I was not thinking clearly at all. I was angry. I was annoyed. I was paranoid. Everybody was tiptoeing around me.
And where was the anger going to? Was it anger at yourself?
Oh, myself completely. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I hated myself. I despised myself. Like, I hated myself to a stage where the windows and the mirrors and everything in the house were covered. Like, if I seen it, it could have triggered me. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you woke up in the hospital, I'm mindful of this is really, really hard. And, you know, you're revisiting it, even if it is blurry. And that's probably a part of the trauma, that it's a self-protection thing, that you're not able to access all these memories because it was so traumatic. But it wasn't a case of, you know, you were brought to hospital, you woke up. Like, am I right in thinking you were gone? Like, you were unconscious for some time?
Some time, yeah. Yeah, I'm not even sure how long. I must figure that one out. But I'm not sure how long it was, but yeah.
Yeah. And, like, did they have to try and you know, it was an overdose. Do they have to try and pump your stomach? Is that okay to ask?
Yeah, no, I'm pretty sure those. I got my stomach pumped that night. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just was. I woke up and there was nothing. Nothing. But maybe when I'm in my counselling at the moment, like, we're still trying to dive into that at the moment. Yeah. That's not coming back up for me. That time, that I'm kind of going off what Mam remembers from that time. There's so many points and parts of it that you think you were at rock bottom, and when you think back to it. But I don't remember it. I really don't remember it.
Yeah. And also, at the end of the day, I am not a trained psychotherapist. Yeah. So I'm very mindful of putting my foot in it or saying something inappropriate or causing harm to you or to anyone else listening who may be they've been drawn to this conversation for their own personal reasons. So I have to be very, very mindful of that too.
Yeah.
And respectful of your boundaries. I know you said you're very willing to talk and very open to talk about it.
Oh, I'm a complete open book.
Yeah.
But see, I can speak about the first suicide attempt very easily and freely because I know it was a decision that I made. The second one, I don't know if I made that decision really.
Right.
I don't think I did. I was, like I was saying, I was not in control at that time.
It sounds like you felt a bit overwhelmed after your session with the counsellor.
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
And as you said, all you wanted to do was be with your granny.
I knew that was my last time to have felt safe and happy with the thoughts of being with granny the last time. So I think when I came out of the counselling session, it was automatically bring yourself back to that happy space that I had a few weeks previous.
So she was your anchor in life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. I still think she is.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, there's a robin that sits outside my cake decorating area every single morning, and that's there. And like, Mam keeps telling me to move out, and I'm like, no, I want to stay in Granny's house.
Yeah. Do you feel her with you?
Yeah, she's with me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And now, is that a different feeling to the one you had years ago, where it's, I want to be with her, I'm going to bring myself to her, or is it like, she's here with me, and I'm living in the world now?
Yeah, I definitely don't want to be with her now. I want her to be where she is right now, and she's pushing me on. She's looking
but
after
she's
me.
With you.
She's with
in
me.
This world.
Yeah.
In
yeah,
spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah.
But like, as you said, from getting from there, so like, you were 18 when she passed away. Your attempts at ending your life were at the age of 19, 20.
Yeah.
And now you're 29.
29, yeah.
So it hasn't happened overnight that you have. And actually, it probably goes for your business as well. People sometimes think, oh, they're an overnight success.
Yeah.
You have had your shop for 7 years.
Yeah.
And yet, since the pandemic, you really have noticed an explosion in terms of how the business is going. Mm-hmm. But also, on a personal level, it's only in the last 2 years that you're also... It's amazing, actually, isn't it? It's in the same time frame that your business is improving and really thriving, that you're also now in a much better place on a personal level.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
It all happens at once.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
So now you're getting the help and you're still processing and working through, mm-hmm. but, you know, how do you go from not wanting to be here anymore to opening up your shop 7 years ago? Like, how does that happen when you go into rehab and you're on the path to recovery? What was that journey like for you?
So my rehab was kind of, again, don't remember much of it, only remember the nurses coming to the house every single day.
Okay.
They came every day, they administered my medication, they gave me...
So you had to be monitored?
Yeah, monitored all the time. Then I was in for check-ins, moods, levels, all that. That went on for weeks, months maybe. I went back to work. At the time I was working in Ned Maguire's restaurant in Black Line.
Oh, fab, yeah.
So I obviously begged to go back. I was like, please let me go back, please let me go back. So Mam was in contact with them and she was like, she's a couple of weeks on medication and she's doing really well. The only thing throughout this whole process, all of these years, was that never changed, was my love for work. I was like a sponge for absorbing when I went into a kitchen. I just loved it. I wanted to be there. I felt comfortable there. I was happy there. I just felt like myself. I didn't think about anything else, only what I wanted to learn. So
we know you now as Una Leonard Baker.
Yeah.
But when you were in the kitchen, were you...
Oh, no, I wasn't. I wasn't in the pastry section.
Were you not?
No. I was always kind of either on meats or on pass or like anything else but bacon. But the whole idea of this is when you're 17, 18, 19, you don't want to be on the pastry section because you're the last one out at night. Let's call a spade here.
Fantastic. You're giving me flashbacks of my waitressing days. Yeah.
Are you waiting for the last person? And they're like, yeah, we'll have dessert. And I'm like, really?
Table five are taking their time. Would they ever fucking get the dessert order in? Brilliant.
Yeah, so I was always trying to dodge that area. But I did get put on it when I was off in Black Line. I was on, when I finished up, I was on the dessert section, which I absolutely loved though.
So is that what happened? Did it click then? Wait a second, there's something in this dessert baking crack
that didn't click there. I did enjoy it, but like that, it was still part of the kitchen experience and it was okay. Working as a team and it was like just learning loads of different techniques and everything. So we were off there and then I come home. I was still very fragile up there.
Okay.
Very, very fragile. And I was still just eating my bowl of peas. And it was actually...
I still only
making my bowl of peas. So at the nurses had still...
This might sound like a really ignorant thing to say, but how are you actually surviving if you're only eating that many calories? Are you getting nourishment in other ways?
No. I actually don't know how I survived. I really don't know. But like, I don't know how I survived. So I was eating my bowl of peas, but at the time the nurses had split the bowl. So this was a big thing for me, that I was actually going to eat twice a day instead of once a day. So they showed me that it was physically the same amount of food, but they were splitting it into two bowls.
Right.
So then I do remember like little bits of chicken being added in and like they were building up slowly. But just even to get my mindset around actually eating twice a day instead of just once a day was a big thing for me. But when I was on my way back up to Black Line, after we had decided it was ready for me to go back up, I remember, I don't know what came over me, but I had a massive anxiety attack in the car on the way up. I remember pulling in, it must have been Derry Lynn, somewhere along them lines on the way up, it was outside an agricultural machinery thing, and having a full-on panic attack. And I rang Mam straight away. She had hid two little volumes in somewhere that I could have if this did happen.
Okay, yeah.
And she said she was on her way into Mass and she just looked at her phone and she'd never bring her phone with her. And she just knew and she just prayed. And she was like, please God, make sure it's okay. And she said when she got off the phone to me that day, she drove straight home. She packed a bag, head to Derry Lynn, or head to Black Line. And she didn't come home until I came home that Christmas.
Yeah.
She said her plan was to make sure that I was coming home safe. So she stayed up with me. She held me to sleep every night and made sure I was taking my medication and cooked me my bowl of peas every day. And they were actually brilliant to her up there because we all got staff meals and everything. So she used to come up and have my staff meal and I'd have the bowl of peas. They were so good to her. I cannot tell you how amazing they were to her. Oh, she was just idolized up there. Like, so, yeah.
So and your bond is so obvious. Like,
yeah.
Anyone even who follows your Instagram page, your mom sometimes pops up.
Oh, and she's hilarious.
It's obvious that you guys have great crack together,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. She's a funny woman. Yeah.
So did you notice an improvement? Did she notice an improvement? Was it slow? What are we talking?
It was very slow. Like, that time Getting back into work at that time was really good for me, I thought. I felt, okay, I was taking mum away from home. It was a couple of weeks up to Christmas. Like, I feel guilty for that now when I look back. But for me, I needed to get back into the kitchen because that's where I felt comfortable. But we had made the decision that once that Christmas came, Christmas Eve, we finished up work there. I went home with mum and I wasn't going to come back to work. So my plan then was to stay at home and was to be at home and get myself right. I wasn't even going to go back to college. I took a year out, or I took a semester out to look after myself.
And how did you feel about that?
I knew it was the right thing. Okay. From pleads from my family to get me back, I knew that was the right thing. And I think that, I don't know, I think I wanted it myself. I think I wanted to be, I didn't want to be in the dumps anymore. I think I wanted to help myself a little bit, but I don't know how obvious that was, because I was still probably very depressed and my eating disorder was very obvious at the time as well. But I think I did. I think I wanted help.
Yeah, and you tried counselling, and at the time, you know, the counsellor was doing their best, and but you weren't ready to hear certain things, or the timing of it might have been just a bit off. Was therapy brought in at this stage?
No. Oh, no. No. It was medication only. There was no therapy up until 2 or 3 years ago until I decided.
And was that your decision, or was that advice from other people that you're not ready for it yet?
I think it was a matter of getting me out of the suicidal levels.
Okay.
Before we even went on to the next level.
Yeah, so, let's not even look at that right
yeah,
now.
So I remember, like, when we used to, once a week, we used to go in for our checkups in the rehab clinic after the nurses had come all week, and we would, oh no, they were so silly. Like, it was just ticking a box. How's your mood? 1 to 5. How's this? 1 to 5. How's this? Okay, 1 to 5. Okay. 1 to 5. And I was just going to tick, 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 tick. But that was it. That was the system. Like, and it was once my levels were kind of up, we'd move on to the next plan. But
so are you saying that in a sense that you could cheat the system?
Oh,
if you
yeah, 100%. You're just ticking boxes.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah, okay.
But like, my therapy came then when I was at home. So I was at home, and that was, I came home in the December. So we finished up in December. My nephew's birthday was the 2nd of February. And his little face asking for a John Deere tractor cake was me going, okay, I'll give it a go. So that's when I started baking.
Wow.
That's, so I used to actually have to get up and do something. So yeah. Now this is a cake that I started in January, prepping, organizing, looking up books, reading things, looking at YouTube videos, figuring out how I was going to do it. Where do I even buy fondant? I didn't even have a rolling pin at this stage. And I was like, okay, I'm going to make this cake. So that was where that all happened. So I actually had a perk. I got stuck into it. I started, I made his cake then on the 2nd of February.
Yeah.
And then
how does it turn out?
Oh, from now, terrible. But when I back then, it was unreal. I could have took off into the field, no butter at all. It was class.
Brilliant.
It was unreal.
And I'm sure he was delighted. Oh, that's pretty epic cake.
Yeah, it was deadly. It was deadly. Yeah. But I remember staying up until 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning for three nights in a row, just making this cake and putting so much detail into it.
Yeah,
Like, it was.
Do you have photos of the cake?
I do, yeah. I'll show you the photo.
Oh, I'd love to see one, yeah.
Yeah, so I started making that cake, and then a neighbour would ask me to make another cake, and I'd be like, okay. And then I'd be like, do you know what? I'll try and make cupcakes. Now, most of them would be, you'd have to bin them, like, they were terrible. But my thing was, I would make them. Like, Dad would come in from work, my brother would come in, my mom would come in, Orla would come up, and everyone would be sitting around the table. I would actually be staring at them eating them, and I'm like, well, what do you think?
Yeah.
And they'd be like, yeah, that's really nice.
And it was all about sweet things.
It was just, do you know what it was? It was the creative side of things. I didn't realise that I had that creative side of things where I could see it differently. Like, so I wanted to paint onto cakes. I'd have an idea of how I was going to make something, or somebody would show me a picture of something. I'd be like, oh, I can make that into a cake, no butter at all. And I would, like, I probably couldn't. Like, I know I definitely couldn't, but I'd be just playing around with, like, bits of fondant, and I'd be making designs or making little characters. Or now they didn't turn out like they looked like anything. I'm going to show you a few of the pictures and you're going to laugh at them. But in my head, they looked different, and everyone told me they were amazing. So I was like, cheers, guys.
Yeah.
I'll just keep doing this because look, it's working out.
And I wonder, was it a case of your creativity wasn't being used before?
Yeah,
it sounds like you were in now, in a very freeing place of letting your imagination run and just going with it.
Yeah, which was amazing for me, but not so much Mam, because I was on her kitchen table.
Okay.
And when my imagination flows and my creativity flows, it was like a bomb sight, an absolute bomb sight. So finally we had started fighting again. And I was like, oh, this is normal.
Okay.
People had stopped tiptoeing around me because I was making a mess and I was actually starting to do things. And you know what? Imagine like bumping into your friends and like, do you know when you know somebody is not like being like, oh God, what do I say to her? They were like, well, that cake last week was class. So you probably,
brilliant.
And it was, do you know what? I was able to talk to people again. So that social anxiety of like bumping into people and that was leaving me as well. Well, not completely now. I'd say I probably had about one good day a month, but I was always holding on to that month. And then next month I might have three good days.
Yes.
But you were always holding on to them good days. Like.
And at this stage, we're still talking like you're probably around 20, are you?
Yeah.
So it's not for another 2 years before you open the doors.
Yeah, so 20, then 21, I registered my first business, which was Una's Cakes Creations.
Yeah.
I know I just went wild with that name. But anyway. So that was, I got my, got certified to do like cakes from home and stuff like that.
Yeah,
so
cool.
That was my first cake business. And then I knew that I wanted to do it. I knew I loved to do it. I knew I had to do something.
Yeah.
And I didn't plan on opening a bakery. I was actually in Mullingar. Why was I in Mullingar that day? I still don't know why I was in Mullingar.
Right.
But I had worked in Mullingar previous. So I was worked in a restaurant in Mullingar when I was 17.
Yeah.
And I was on that street, Mount Street. And I was walking up and I was looking around and going, Jesus, this changed an awful lot. And I just remember walking past this shop and had a massive big window and there was a little cafe running inside it and had like a sign of A4 print on the window and it said turnkey €750 a month. I was like, I'm going to walk in here and see what I do. I walked into that shop and I had this overwhelming feeling. I cannot describe it to you, but I knew I was in the right place at the right time.
Wow.
I don't know. I can't describe it. I literally cannot describe it. But the smile didn't leave my face. I had no intentions of opening a bakery, by the way. I just knew I couldn't keep wrecking Mam's house. Like.
Yeah.
So I went in there and the man came out and I spoke to him and he gave me the landlady's number. And then I was like, I'm meeting the landlady. So I rang her, organised a meeting with her. Went over the next day. Was it the next day or later that day? No, it was the next day because it was Conor's, the 2nd of the 2nd. So it was Conor's birthday. Signed the lease. And there we had it. We have a bakery. Wow. And Mam was looking at me going, what are you going to do? I was like, I don't know. What am I going to do? I was like, fuck it. Sure, I have something to get up for every day, don't I?
Yeah.
So it was with no plan. I only got actually a business plan together about 2 years ago. The plan was to get up every day and do something that you love to do.
Yeah.
And I knew it was going to be my happy space.
You had such a positive focus, yeah.
Yeah, that was it. It was literally, the plan was always just to make cakes.
And with every day that passed, did you feel like you were getting stronger? At this point, like, where is your eating disorder at?
Eating disorder was improving as such as I was eating, but my mentality towards it was not improving. As in, like, I always was thinking about it, worrying about it. I always had this conscious thought about myself. And do you know what? When things get tough now, I still kind of slip back into it.
Okay.
Now, I don't slip back into an eating disorder, but I do sometimes like have thoughts and I'm like, no, I know what they
negative
are now.
Negative self-thoughts.
Yeah.
When you looked in the mirror, what did you see at this point?
I didn't look in the mirror.
Okay. All right. So you still avoided your reflection.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So you're feeling positive and excited and this is the right path for me and I love to bake and I'm just going to keep trucking here and do this and I'm going to open a business. But behind it all, you're still fighting that voice in your head that's telling you negative things.
Yeah. But also on the other side of things, I had this overwhelming feeling of I've already hit rock bottom. Like there is literally only one place I can go.
Mm.
And
you were excited about this. Oh. So this is all stuff that leads to living life, being alive.
Yeah.
So this is positive.
Yeah.
This is really positive.
Oh, when I was opening that shop, I was like telling Mam and Dad, I was like, oh, I'm going to have 10 shops in the next couple of years. Like, I was like,
good on you.
I was like, pure, like, hitting, reaching for the stars.
Let's
go
for it.
Yeah, there was no stopping me at that stage.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I couldn't get 10 customers in the door, but anyway.
Come here, what was it like in the early days?
Oh, What was it like in the early days? Oh my God. Like when you put a 22-year-old girl that looks like she's about 15 into a business to run, and you're trying to get credit, you're trying to open up bank accounts, you're trying to figure out how to run a business that you've never ran before. I've never actually ran in, I never worked in a cafe before.
Okay.
So I didn't know what I was doing. It was a struggle. Mm. From day one, it was a struggle. But I think I laughed a good bit of it off. And now when I look back on it, I'm like, I don't blame them. I wouldn't have given me credit at the time. So I remember like getting orders in like and having to pay out in cash. Like they wouldn't give me direct debits or anything like
right,
that.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
Then like if I used to hope like every day, I'd be like, if I get 5 customers today and 6 tomorrow, like wouldn't that be like even one step further? Like I used to be always like nearly counting my customers. I remember like one day breaking 65 euro, like that was what had come in the till. And I remember it was over 50 euro and being like, yes. Oh my God, we're doing so well.
Yeah.
And remember the day we broke 100 euro, like someone, like we had spent it or we'd taken in 100 euro.
Pop
and
the champagne.
Oh, literally. I was like, we're going places. We are really going places, guys. And that was probably like 5 or 6 weeks in. Like we were still not like,
yeah.
you'd be lucky if you had 2 or 3 customers.
Right.
Yeah. But oh. you were in a recession at the time.
Of course.
Well.
Coming out
of a recession.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
But
and
look,
as you said, you're only 22. I mean, no. It's fantastic what you were doing.
But
at
I
such
was
a young
never
age.
money motivated. I never cared what came in the till. Like, I could have actually not even done a till reading for a few days because it just didn't bother me. I was like literally making cakes. Whatever I sold, if I had enough money to go down and buy the ingredients for the cake that was on order, I would.
And going from where you came from, as you said, like this was a huge progression.
Yeah.
And this is a positive thing in your life.
Yeah.
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 Then, I mean, you know, what you've already told us is the kind of stuff that stops people in their tracks. And, you know, you've had so much to deal with. But then I suppose 2 years into the business, there's another bombshell when your mom is given a diagnosis of cancer.
Yeah. But I also still feel like somebody was looking down on us. And I know that, I don't know how to describe this without, because we definitely didn't want mom to have a diagnosis of cancer
of
at
course,
all.
Yeah.
But I had actually made the decision. I went to Vietnam in the January with my partner at the time, Owen. We had travelled and we had made the decision that
the following January.
No, the January before mom's diagnosis. So
okay.
That January.
Yeah.
So we had made the decision that the business was not working. Like there was no way we could keep doing this, paying rent. We were living together. Like he was paying some of my bills for me. Like financially it just didn't work. But I was like, what else am I going to do? Like this is what I do. But we were kind of like, no, it can't continue anymore. It was just too much. And then we were like, okay, we'll make a plan. We'll finish out the Camogie and hurling year. And in September, all of our friends were kind of moving to Australia and America and they were traveling. We were at that age, like we wanted to do a bit of it as well.
Yeah.
So I had my heart set on Australia and I had contacted 3 or 4 bakeries over there. And I was like, oh, I'm definitely going to get in there. Like I can do it. I know I can do it. And I'll be able to train over there and work over there and do my patisserie over there. So we actually, Owen was in America at the time he was working. So in the April, I went out to San Francisco to meet him. And it was, I think it was Easter Saturday or Easter Sunday. I rang home and I got off the phone call and I just said to Owen, I was like, there's something going on at home.
Mm.
And he was like, what? No, you're mad. Go on, you go. Go on, you're fine, you're grand. And I was like, no, honestly, there's something going on at home. And I felt sick for the whole rest of the trip. And I got home and my mom and my sister picked me up from the airport. And like, I was like a little bit late. And you know the way your mother gets so annoyed with you when you're late and you're not in the right place at the wrong time. And you know when you're doing like all the dodgy, like drop off and pick ups in the airport that you're not meant to do.
Yeah, yeah, you're anxious. They're looking at you going, would you or he ever hurry up? Because I can't stay here forever.
But there was none of that. So I was like, what's going on? So I go into the car.
Okay.
And I was like, I had 4 wedding cakes, I think, in 2 days that when I got home. So they never said that to me. It was that Sunday.
You're like, what's going on here?
But I knew there was something going on.
Okay.
And that Sunday, mom had said that she had got diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer.
Okay.
I was like, oh no. Oh no. Oh no. You don't know how to deal with it. You don't know how to cope with it. You're just devastated. You're driving into work every day and you cry the whole way in. You go to work, you do what you have to do. And on the way home, you cry the whole way home. And that's it. And it's that part of like the diagnosis where you don't know what the next step is.
Yeah.
And I think when you're given the next step, you're kind of like, oh, okay, this is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But it's the in between of not knowing what's going to happen next. So we had There was a couple of weeks then before she was going in for her schedule as such, we were told. So we were going into Professor Cronin for her schedule. And it was myself and my auntie that were going in with her, and we had our diaries ready, and we were ready for this year plan. So it was going to be surgery, chemo, and maybe radiation, and then she would have been fine.
Yeah,
that's what we were told anyway. But we had this sickly feeling again. This sickly feeling come up, and we just knew. And me and Mam had kind of had a little bit of a talk about it. We had went to Tullamore a week before, and we both spoke and both kind of said that we just weren't sure about this. So we went in that day, and the cancer had spread to four different areas with five different tumours, and she'd got re-diagnosed with stage 4 inflammatory cancer. So that was another shock.
Yeah.
And hard to take in and hard to understand, because we didn't know what it was, and there's not much research in this type of cancer. So okay. This cancer is like something that can pop up, but when it comes up, it can grow. It's completely separate, different to one that had already grown. So there's no treatment for it. So they have to act fast and figure out what it is so they can treat it
right. Every
time. So it's popped up, I think, 3 or 4 times now in the last 5 years. And
so you say that last 5 years. So first it was a stage 2 diagnosis.
Yes.
And then this was stage
4.
4.
Yeah.
And like, so, I've seen your mom on your page.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I suppose this maybe is like, and I'm somebody who has been through cancer myself.
Yes.
So I don't mean to come across ignorant, but
no.
Like, you'd never know. She looks like she's,
oh, she's
flying
fast.
It.
She is flying it.
Yeah.
She is like if you could like burst her, she's just positivity.
Yeah.
Like, she's literally she is like,
well, you didn't lick it off a stone, as they say. Yeah, is that where you get your glittering personality?
I don't know, maybe I'm hanging out with her too much, but like, she is like, she's class. She's one of those people that you want to be around.
Yeah,
like, she is unbelievable. Like, even when she goes up into the ward, up to level 7, like, they are all like, well, Pauline, like, she will sit there and have the chat with anybody.
Yeah,
and like,
yeah.
She just, I don't know, I think she brings it to a room when she comes into it. Like, so
yeah.
I think she brings that to her cancer diagnosis as well. She's like, I didn't choose to have cancer. It chose to come to me. Like, I'm getting on with my life.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Fair play.
I know. She's,
great attitude
she's,
to
she's,
have.
Oh, unbelievable. But obviously, like, she probably does have her down days.
Of course, up and down and treatment.
Yeah.
And where is she at the moment?
So she's gets treatment every 3 weeks at the moment.
Okay.
And then she's all of her scans and everything in between.
Yeah.
But at the moment, there is no movement.
And no movement is good.
No movement is good.
We'll
movement.
Take it.
Yeah. So just before lockdown, she had a surgery in the February, and then she had a couple of months of really intense chemo, and then she'd surgery again in October, and then she had like a couple of weeks of radiation, and then she was given she was told there a couple of months ago now that she can take a break for a little while.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Delighted to hear that.
Yeah, it's great.
So, but at the stage of being told the first time, you know, as you said, you were like, right, we just need to park the business, because anyway, it's not really working.
Yes.
And I'm going to just kind of put my energy into Mam.
Yeah.
And we need to make sure that she's all right.
Yeah.
But then you realised, well, wait a second, actually, maybe I need to revisit the business idea.
So I did. Like, the business at that stage, the minute that we were told that Mam was diagnosed, I was like, I haven't even thought of Australia since. I didn't think of anything else. Like, my main thing
that was just wiped away.
Wiped away. Gone.
And that's gone now forever.
Gone. Yeah, no, I don't want to do it. I have no interest in doing it. I wouldn't mind going over and travelling and seeing the world and stuff like that, but no. This is my main focus then was business and Mam. Mm. So we were working on both of those things. And you know what? If someone told you as a really, really busy, like 20, what was I, 4 or 5 year old, that you need to take a day off a week to spend with your mother, you'd be like, no, I'm not doing that. I actually had the opportunity to do that. And that's how I seen it.
Yeah.
And I still see it like that. I'm like, I would not take a Monday off to spend a full day with Mam and get to know her and like spend that precious time with her. If she didn't get diagnosed.
Yeah, yeah.
And we would have lost, like, not lost, but like, that would have been years of just being so busy, not being able to put the time and effort into it. And that's how I see it.
Isn't that the unexpected gift that sometimes a diagnosis like a cancer or something else can bring to someone or a family? Yeah.
Yeah. And that's how I look at it. I see those days as I get to do that. And even we went up yesterday to bring our treatment and I had a million and one things to do. And it was the first time in 5 years that I literally went, Okay. I just need to park all of that stuff. I get to bring Mom up to her treatment. The fact that we're still here 5 years on.
Yeah.
And we get to do it. And she was told that, like, she was going on a trial treatment that might not work and that we're going to do our best. We don't know.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, that we still get to do this.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as you said, like, she held you at night while you were experiencing your night terrors. Now there's an element of you being able to be there for her.
Yeah.
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 It's gorgeous.
Yeah. And asking her questions. I don't know if many people do this. I know so much about Mam, about her early years, about her teenage years, about the crap she went through and about her dad passing away and how she felt and what it was like for her. And I just like find like those days I get to actually get to know her so much better than I ever would have, because
it's a really good message.
Yeah, it's really like,
because often we don't like, we're, you know, so kind of consumed by the runnings of a normal day-to-day life that yeah. you're trucking along, but you don't sometimes ask about
yeah,
the person.
Exactly. And like even love stories, I'm like, who was your first boyfriend? Like,
and I'm like, getting all the gossip.
Oh, I get all the gossip. And I'm like, tell me all about them, all the nights in the beehive and all the trips that they took. And I'm like, tell me all about that. I want to know every detail. I know every detail of her wedding day. Every detail. Down to the flowers she used, the colours of this, the colours of that, how she planned it. Like I have
oh, it's gorgeous,
Una. Yeah, yeah. So I think they're a blessing in disguise those days.
Yeah. And again, back to your why, then again, now it's kind of mushroomed into a different thing.
Yes.
So your why wasn't just, okay, this is, you know, the baking is good for me. It's a positive focus.
Yeah, it was a matter of like, get your shit together now, because yeah. this, you need this more than you want this.
Yeah.
You need to be here. You need to make this work, because this is where you're comfortable. This is where you're excelling. This is where you're happy. And like, there's a lot of shit going on out there, and you need to be there for Mom as well. But if you want to be here, you need to put your head down and figure out how you're going to do it. So my first plan I came up with was like, if I get one wedding cake a month, that'll pay for the rent, or I'll pay a bit of the rent, or
yeah.
two wedding cakes a month. I think that was my plan. So I went in to work. A couple of weeks later, I made 5 or 6 dummy wedding cakes and just kept posting them online.
Okay.
And then I was like doing open days. I was welcoming everyone in. I was putting a ton of cake out, and I'm like, eat all the cake, just book with me.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And it worked.
It worked. Yeah, I was doing like 120 weddings the following year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. It really did work. Yeah.
And come here, what is the situation at now? Because I take it you're not a solo operation.
No, I'm not. So I know I have a massive, fantastic team in there. Massive being, it's more than just me. So we have we have a kitchen team. We have our online team. We have our front of house team. We have our office team. And then we have our behind the scenes team. Like, so there is a good few people knocking around there.
Yeah. So again, now, you know, I'm talking to you today and you're 29 and the last 2 years have been massive on a personal level and a professional level. So again, now where are you? Where are you at now in terms of having a disordered relationship with food and all the rest? You told me this morning anyway that you had turkey burgers for brekkie. I was like, what would you have in a normal morning? He was like, turkey burgers.
Yeah.
So you're very conscious of what you eat. You eat very well, very healthy.
I do. I eat quite healthy, but I eat quite healthy because I train quite a bit. So
because I would have thought if you were working in a bakery that the temptation to eat all the treats.
Oh yeah, no, I don't go. I probably don't go a day without eating a treat as well. But
okay.
Like, I'm very much so balanced at the moment. So
great.
I'm able for
brilliant.
That. Now, don't get me wrong. There's some days I go in there and we're like testing out new recipes, and I'm like, yep, a bit of everything.
But I suppose if you're around sweet things all the time, it doesn't become like, so if somebody was fresh into a bakery environment who had never maybe been around sweet things
they want to try everything.
I want to try it all. Whereas it's your business.
Yeah.
You're used to it.
Yeah. Well, you can't really take a chunk out of someone's cake. Like. Wouldn't really be good for business.
So you have a really, as you said, balance. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, but that's not to say that I don't have my bad days. Like, I remember when COVID hit and I had lost control. I didn't know what was happening. There was no support to put in. I was an emotional wreck. I was like, what am I going to do? And I went back to that control thing again straight away with food.
Okay.
So it does like creep in, and I do probably need to look into it a little bit more and deal with it a little bit more, but it's definitely there. Like, there is definitely that like probably been a bit over healthy sometimes, and I do eat turkey burgers in the morning, but that's because I don't like breakfast food.
Okay.
I don't like,
you're not a fan of porridge.
No, nothing along those lines. I would eat my dinner, like if I was making dinner for breakfast the next morning, like, I'm just one of those people. Doesn't matter what time of the day. I'm such a foodie, so I'd eat anything anytime.
And obviously another really positive focus in your life has been sport, has been Camogie.
Yes. Like throughout the whole lot. Like,
so that, you kept it going the whole time.
The whole time.
And you've training later.
I've training later. Yeah, I'm back down to
how often do you train?
I train probably about 5 to 6 times a week.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So and either what's your on next the pitch match? Or not. Who are we playing next? Oh, we're playing Laois this weekend, and then we're at the All Ireland quarterfinals the following weekend.
Mighty stuff.
Yeah,
it's exciting.
Yeah, it's very exciting.
So here we are in 2022, and you have your own book out. Congratulations! Called Sweet Therapy: The Joy of Baking. And it's a cookery book. It's a book about baking, but it's slightly different because, again, your story is so powerful.
Yeah, it's a book about hope, I think.
Yeah.
And baking, a bit of both.
Yeah. And how baking became a part of your recovery, and it was a savior to you. Yeah.
I still, like, even when you say it, I'm like, oh yeah, that's a book I actually have. Because this is my first interview, so I'm kind of like, oh wow, it's actually there. It's
yes. Yeah. It's real.
Yeah.
And in the book, you share your own story, but you also kind of go through, which I love, it's kind of like you explain everything from what you need when it comes to baking, the ingredients, why you like them, you know, how you use them, because they often speak about baking being a science. It's very, you can't mess around. Like, I'm a bit of a, when I'm making my food, it's a spice here, a bit of this there, I'll just lash it all in, hope for the best. You can't do that when it comes to baking a cake.
Meet your sister, I'm the exact same as that. I love to do that. So that's why with the book, I kept everything really simple. And you can, like, if you're making one of the brownies, you can play around with recipes. You can, like, change it up, like, and throw something different in if you like a flavour.
So we can recreate the gorgeous brownies or bars or cakes that we get.
Yes, yeah.
In your
bakery.
And the
Doty bars are in there as well.
Oh, fab. Are you nervous about revealing your secrets?
No, not at all. I'm just nervous about how people make them. I'm like,
okay.
Because I'm like, I make them one way, and I'm like, because brownies.
Well, as in, you don't want them to mess it up.
No, well, of course not. But like, brownies are really hard to understand when to take out of the oven. Like, they're meant to come out when they're a little bit wobbly, like in the center.
Okay. So will you be reviewing then if people are tagging you? Be like, I'm not going to share.
Yeah, I'm going to be like, it takes my 10 minutes earlier.
Yeah, or delete. No, she'll be nice.
No, I have it very well. Like, I think that I am very clear on the parts that people normally get a bit worried about when they're baking. So I'm clear on that. So hopefully.
So your Granny Doty would have been the woman for the sweet treats back in the day, and you know, would have loved to have given you all the yummy things. How would she feel about you looking at you now? What do you think she would say to you today, knowing what you've come through, what you've achieved, and where you're at now?
She wasn't a woman for words.
I think
Granny would have spoke to me through food and probably just put on a fresh brown bread and a cup of tea and just sat there like and had that. Like, that's, she wouldn't be a great woman for words. So she would have just gave you her time and just been.
And vibe, atmosphere.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah.
Lovely. Yeah. Lovely. Una, it's been amazing to talk to you. I have been, like, as you saw with me there, it was impossible not to be bawling when you were speaking. It's your story is incredibly powerful. You've got such a gorgeous lightness, a touch about you, but there's such depth to your personality, and you've been through so much. But I'm so delighted to see you doing so well. Obviously, it's fantastic to see your business thriving. But what's more important, that you, on a personal level, that you're doing really, really good, and continued healing and recovery the whole time. And I'm going to have to book in with you to make a cake, because I know if I don't, I'll probably be on a waiting list for the next 5 years. So can we chat after this?
Yes, 100% cake coming up.
Thanks a million. The book is Sweet Therapy: The Joy of Baking, and it's out now, and all good bookshops are available online. Thanks a million.
Thank you for having me.
You're amazing. Wow. How are you feeling?
I feel like I'm after doing therapy.
Well, that was one of the most moving conversations I have ever had. And I'm so grateful to Una for her willingness to speak about such difficult times in her life. And I know she's going to help so many people who listen. This has been Ready to Be Real.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.